Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we've got Sean with us. I don't want to forget that we do have the appeal to heaven, or I should say the prayer. And if you are going to engage in an appeal to heaven, you can always join in. The information is still on the website. And the focus, if we're going to get this done, folks, it has to be central on full compliance to the Constitution. Things that we may like. Oh, well, that's kind of a nice thing. Until it is amended to the Constitution, we're not doing it. We got to stop doing these things. And then we can actually have an honest conversation to say, well, how are we going to get that done? And my my feedback, if you're asking, is keep the federal government out of most all things domestic. Most all things. No reason for them to be involved in any domestic matter. No. None. Keep them out. They do a great job in killing people. They do a great job in, you know, security and so forth when they're focused on doing those things for us. But it seems like they're killing us and they're securing us or locking us down. And that's not what they're supposed to be doing. So welcome back, Sean.
And good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No, I appreciate it. And as a matter of fact, I'm ready to kind of continue because we just dove into, and just a couple of comments beyond what George Mason stated regarding slavery. Very powerful statement where he kind of laid it out here, calling upon heaven to basically create national calamities for this nation because the position we're taking regarding slavery. Now, we just had Mr. Pinckney make a comment that basically felt, well, if slavery would be wrong, it'd be justified by the example of the world. Okay, so hey, everybody else is doing it. And then now General Pinckney, and I don't know what their relation is, and I probably should, but it's just, it's kind of nice, but it's not that important for me to know. But General Pinckney from South Carolina, same with Mr. Pinckney from South Carolina. Now, General Pinckney is going to make his comments, and I think he actually has a different view. And when we really start looking at most of these men, they're going to really, well, I'll let them speak for themselves. And so that's probably the best thing to do. So, Sean, let's go ahead and start off with General Pinckney from South Carolina. Thank you.
General Pinckney declared it to be his firm opinion that if himself and all his colleagues were to sign the Constitution and use their personal influence, it would be of no avail towards obtaining the assent of their constituents. South Carolina and Georgia cannot do without slaves. As to Virginia, she will gain by stopping the importations. Her slaves will rise in value, and she has more than she wants. It would be unequal to require South Carolina and Georgia to confederate on such unequal terms. He said the royal assent before the revolution had never been refused to South Carolina as to Virginia. He contended that the importation of slaves would be for the interest of the whole Union. The more slaves, the more produce to employ the carrying trade, the more consumption also, and the more of this, the more of revenue for the common treasury. He admitted it to be reasonable that slaves should be dutied like other imports, but should consider a rejection of the clause as an exclusion of South Carolina from the Union.
Okay. So again, he feels like they have to have it, even though if they tried to use their influence to stop it, they wouldn't give it up. And I don't know if he's justifying it. I just believe he's trying to provide a pragmatic view. trying. Mr. Baldwin of Georgia, now another Southerner, speaks up regarding Mason's forecast of calamities. Go ahead.
Mr. Baldwin had conceived national objects alone to be before the convention, not such as like the present were of a local nature. Georgia was decided on this point. That state has always hitherto supposed a general government to be the pursuit of the central states, who wish to have a vortex for everything, that her distance would preclude her from equal advantage, and that she could not prudently purchase it by yielding national powers. From this it might be understood in what light she would view an attempt to abridge one of her favorite prerogatives. If left to herself, she may probably put a stop to the evil. As one ground for this conjecture, he took notice of the sect of Blank, which he said was a respectable class of people who carried their ethics beyond the mere equality of men, extending their humanity to the claims of the whole animal creation. Not sure why that Blank was in there.
Yeah, so I don't know either. Maybe they couldn't read the text or what have you. I don't know. Okay, so now Mr. Wilson opines. Go ahead.
Mr. Wilson observed that if South Carolina and Georgia were themselves disposed to get rid of the importation of slaves in a short time, as had been suggested, they would never refuse to unite because the importation might be prohibited. As the section now stands, all articles imported are to be taxed. Slaves alone are exempt. This is, in fact, a bounty on that article.
Okay, so Mr. Gary of Massachusetts.
Mr. Gary thought we had nothing to do with the conduct of the states as to slaves, but ought to be careful not to give any sanction to it.
Okay, Mr. Dickinson of Delaware.
Mr. Dickinson considered it as inadmissible on every principle of honor and safety that the importation of slaves should be authorized to the states by the Constitution. The true question was whether the national happiness would be promoted or impeded by the importation, and this question ought to be left to the national government, not to the states particularly interested. If England and France permit slavery, slaves are at the same time excluded from both those kingdoms. Greece and Rome were made unhappy by their slaves. He could not believe that the southern states would refuse to confederate on the account apprehended, especially as the power was not likely to be immediately exercised by the general government.
Okay, Mr. Williamson.
Mr. Williamson stated that the law of North Carolina on the subject, to wit, that it did not directly prohibit the importation of slaves. It imposed a duty of $5 on each slave imported from Africa, 10 on each slave, each from elsewhere, and 50 on each from a state licensing manumission. He thought the southern states could not be members of the Union if the clause should be rejected, and that it was wrong to force anything down not absolutely necessary, and which any state must disagree to.
Okay, let me see. Let's just keep going with Mr. King of Massachusetts.
Mr. King thought the subject should be considered in a political light only. If two states would not agree to the Constitution as stated on one side, he could affirm with equal belief on the other that great and equal opposition would be experienced from the other states. He remarked on the exemption of slaves from duty, whilst every other import was subject to it, as an inequality that could not fail to strike the commercial sagacity of the northern and the middle states.
Okay. Mr. Langdon of New Hampshire.
Mr. Langdon was strenuous for giving the power to the general government. He could not, with a good conscience, leave it with the states, who could then go on with the traffic without being restrained by the opinions here given that they will themselves cease to import slaves.
Okay. Now, just to be clear, they're really talking about just that, ceasing the importation, not ending slavery. Now, again, the South, and for some reason, Georgia and South Carolina, were really in a deficit for slaves. Now, I don't know if that's just because they were still growing or for whatever the reason. It may have been because of the post-war, because that was one of their claims, that they lost a lot of slaves that, you know, bargained for their freedom by fighting for the Union. So, as we, you know, look at what they're doing, it's kind of interesting because there's, you know, every once in a while somebody's putting the morality of this on the table, and some people are just saying, hey, look, you know, we got to have it type of thing, and trying to be amoral about it. But it seems like everybody in the room, it's kind of like going around and they're all piping in their own thoughts. So let's just keep going with Mr. Langdon.
Mr. Langdon was strenuous for giving the power to the general government. He could not with a good conscience leave it with the states. Oh, I read this already.
Yeah, you did.
He could go on with the traffic without being restrained by the opinions here, given that they will themselves cease to import slaves.
Yeah, okay.
General Pinckney.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thought himself bound to declare candidly that he did not think South Carolina would stop her importations of slaves in any short time, but only stop them occasionally as she now does. He moved to commit the cause that slaves might be made liable to an equal tax with other imports, which he thought right, and which would remove one difficulty that had been started.
Okay, Mr. Rutledge.
Mr. Rutledge, if the convention thinks that North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia will ever agree to the plan, unless their right to import slaves be untouched, the expectation is vain. The people of those states would never be such fools as to give up so important an interest. He was strenuous against striking out the section and seconded the motion of General Pinckney for a commitment. Mr. Governor Morris wished the whole subject to be committed, including the clauses relating to taxes on exports and to a navigation act. These things may form a bargain among the northern and southern states.
Okay. Mr. Butler?
Mr. Butler declared that he never would agree to the power of taxing exports.
Okay. Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Sherman said it was better to let the southern states import slaves than to part with them. If they made that a sin qua non, he was opposed to tax on slaves imported as making the matter worse, because it implied they were property. He acknowledged that if the power of prohibiting the importation should be given to the general government, that it would be exercised. He thought it would be its duty to exercise the power.
Okay, Mr. Reed.
I think that's a very good point he's bringing up right there. Because what came to my mind was, if they allow them to tax them and classify them as property, now the general government can't say that it's, you know, anything else, because they've already agreed that it's property.
Right. Okay. Mr. Reed.
Mr. Reed was for the commitment, provided the clause concerning taxes on exports should also be committed.
Okay.
Mr. Sherman observed that clause had been agreed to and therefore could not be committed.
Okay.
Mr. Randolph was for committing an order that some middle ground might, if possible, be found. He could never agree to the clause as it stands. He would sooner risk the Constitution. He dwelt on the dilemma to which the convention was exposed. By agreeing to the clause, it would revolt the Quakers, the Methodists, and many others in the states having no slaves. On the other hand, two states might be lost to the Union. Let us then, he said, try the chance of a commitment. On the question for committing the remaining part of Section 4 and 5 of Article 7, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, abstained. Connecticut, aye. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, aye. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, aye. And Georgia, aye.
Okay, 7-3. Aye, or in favor. So it passed. Now, Let me see here. We could go on, folks. And as a matter of fact, what I want to do is kind of just cruise through this because they get into the navigation acts and other issues. But I want to kind of get back to the debt. And that's a little bit further down. And once we're done kind of with this section, because this is where they're kind of massaging very specific parts of the Constitution. You'll notice that the whole day they practically deliberated. I'm sure they still broke into their subcommittees, but they deliberated on the issues of what the language or what they were seeking to be put into the Constitution. I mean, in other words, they're really moving forward in forming the Constitution. So with that, let's start off with the debt. Do you see that just a little further down? Debts. Now, right above that, this is where Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina basically kind of talks. And then there's this little note, and this is at the very bottom of page 348. And so what we're looking at is this little insertion where it says, here insert the report from the Journal of the Convention of this date. That's Madison's little note to himself. And then, quote, the committee report that in their opinion the following additions should be made to the report now before the convention, namely. And then it goes into the debts. Are you with me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So let's cover that part moving down through that regarding the debts and so forth. Go ahead.
At the end of the first clause of the first section of the seventh article, add, quote, for payment of the debts and necessary expenses of the United States, provided that no law for raising any branch of revenue except what may be specially appropriated for the payment of interest on debts or loans shall continue in force for more than blank years.
Yep, keep going. Quote, yep, go ahead.
At the end of the second clause, second section, the seventh article, add, quote, and with Indians within limits of any state not subject to the laws thereof. At the end of the 16th clause of the second section, seventh article, add, quote, and to provide as may become necessary from time to time for the well managing and securing the common property and general interest and welfare of the United States in such manner as shall not interfere with the governments of individual states in matters which respect only their internal police or for which their individual authorities may be competent. At the end of the first section, 10th article, add, he shall be of the age of 35 years and a citizen of the United States and shall have been an inhabitant thereof for 21 years. Is that about the president?
35 years a citizen, inhabited there for 20. I think that that may be the president, or it may still be the Senate. Yeah, because that's the Senate's age. Yeah.
After the second section of the 10th article, insert the following as a third section: the president of the United States shall have a privy council, which shall consist of the president of the Senate, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the principal officer in the respective departments of foreign affairs, domestic affairs, war, marine, and finance, as such departments of office shall from time to time be established, whose duty it shall be to advise him in the matters respecting the execution of his office, which he shall think proper to lay before them. But their advice shall not conclude him, nor affect his responsibility for the measures which he shall adopt.
Now, I think that's kind of interesting because all that language just didn't get included into the Constitution. But let me just make this note, though. As they're reading these things to be inserted here, and I just imagine, see, they didn't have a mimeograph. They didn't have, like, an overhead projector. You know what I mean? In other words, they're literally doing this with a slate and chisel and, or, you know, very crude methodology of sitting down and scribbling on their own paper that they had. And so, you know, I could see why in their day, they needed a large room just to accommodate the workspace for each of the individuals if they're actually putting these things in. Now, I know that there's probably the secretary, Mr. Williams or whomever, is probably maintaining, you know, everything to go in, you know, for everybody to make sure that that gets done right. But anybody that wants to, you know, stay abreast of where they're talking, what they're talking about and everything else, so they can see those changes that they're happening so that they can get engaged, then I see everybody with a little, you know, quiver and paper or parchment and, you know, writing these things in on a working copy or what have you. And it's not like they had even erasers and that type of stuff. I'm just, the effort and what they had to do to, you know, manage that kind of information going on paper back in those days. I'm sure they probably had ways of doing it, but it just boggles my mind because it's not like working on a computer with different documents and bringing them forward. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think that we kind of take things like that for granted nowadays. When you actually think about the effort that had to go into what they were trying to accomplish, just right. Like you're saying, on the minuscule task of just keeping record of what was going on.
Right.
You know, they wrote on parchment. They had to have ink. Like you said, the wells, the quills, everything. Everybody had to have that. You know.
Yep. That's right. So, all right. So let's go ahead and wrap this up. Then we get down to kind of a vote here on adjourning or what have you. But let's keep, go ahead.
Okay. At the end of the second section of the 11th article, add, quote, the judges of the Supreme Court shall be triable by the Senate on impeachment by the House of Representatives. Oh, I wish they would have left that in.
Left that in, yeah. Keep going.
Quote, between the fourth and fifth lines of the third section of the 11th article, after the word controversies, insert, quote, between the United States and an individual state or the United States and an individual person, end quote. A motion to rescind the order of the House respecting the hours of meeting and adjourning was negatived.
Okay.
And Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. I'm not sure what this is about.
Yeah, so I think that they were just looking to actually kind of end the day, I think, because if you notice where we are, there's still quite a few people that still speak till right. The end of the day. So they said, hey, no, we're not ready yet. And actually, as you can see here, Mr. Gary and Mr. McHenry moved to insert right after they did this. To wit, and in some of the cases, they're saying, this needs to be inserted between this line and this line. I could just see them writing a little line, cutting it out, and actually, you know, moving the paper around like little pieces of paper. Anyway, yeah. I have no idea how they did it, but they did it.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. And that's what I was going to ask you, if there's any archive of this, like the effects that I guess they just said threw it in the garbage or whatever they did with it back in those days.
Well, you know, one thing I will say about the historians is that they covered those types of things in very good detail, like at the Smithsonian and that type of stuff. They did kind of, you know, capture that type of stuff. So I'm sure somebody knows and can give us a really good detailed description. But if you ask that person, you know, what were the key things that they fought over? Or, you know, how did things migrate from the very beginning to significantly change at the very end? They would probably not be able to tell you those types of nuances.
Right.
Well, that's a lot of reading. I'm not doing that. Anyway, okay, so we're going into break. With that, we will come right back and we will pick up Mr. Gary, Governor Morris, and some other comments of, again, they're putting together more comments and clauses into the Constitution and providing some feedback as they go. And that's where we're at right now, is where they're providing some feedback. So we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're going to get into some other information. And so as I kind of threw it out there, and I want to make sure I didn't gloss this over, that Mr. Gary and Mr. McHenry moved to insert after the second section, Article 7, the following clause, to wit, quote, "The legislature shall pass no bill of attainder nor any ex post facto law," close quote. So now we can, because you can actually see where these ideas came from, these little lines, so that when you're looking at the Constitution, it was truly an amalgamation, galumphery, or this huge hodgepodge of mixtures of ideas that were pouring in from all of these men. It's not like they all, I don't want people to have this misconception that they were all humming and the same ideas came into everybody's head. Not at all. But the fact is, if you look at the magnitude of the Constitution, the amount of time that the convention functioned, and what they had available to them to get the work done, and what the end product really was, it's amazing how complete and, you know, how innovative and just the power and the magnitude of what these men did is just, I think, we as a people today completely marginalize what happened in this convention. And so that kind of goes down this path of me kind of addressing this this time of year where we have the conventionites and the anti-conventionites all meeting and, you know, I'll just say posturing to say, we've got to have a convention, give us a blank check so we can mark up the Constitution, and vice versa. No, we can't have a convention, as if, you know, the only thing we can do is either talk about a convention or not a convention, which just frustrates me. But we'll get into that when we're done with the notes, because I want to kind of provide that little bit of oversight. Anyway, just helping you understand that this was an epoch. This truly was a change in paradigms as to government. So let's go ahead and dive into Mr. Gary of Massachusetts.
And just to give people a little something to nibble on, we realized that the Save America Act election legislation has been in the Senate for almost a year now, and they're still arguing about it, and we haven't had a budget. We've been on a continuing resolution for like the last 10 years, and these men developed a whole new system of government like nothing ever before in the world in just this short time that they were in convention. And these knuckleheads we have today can't even pass simple legislation.
Yeah, and so, I think that's because they are basically supporting the derailing of the Constitution. And I mean, I think that these globalists who have control over the Senate are trying to get all their pins set up so that when the ball comes down the lane, it's going to, you know, give them the strike that they're looking for. So anyway, yeah, it's pretty pathetic. Let's go ahead with
Mr. Gary. Yeah. Mr. Gary urged the necessity of this prohibition, which he said was greater in the national than the state legislature, because the number of members in the former being fewer were on that account the more to be feared. Mr. Governor Morris thought the precaution as to ex post facto laws unnecessary, but essential as to bills of attainder.
Now, hold on here. So, do you know, folks, what an ex post facto law is? An ex post facto law is a law that takes something that was legal and makes it illegal so they can come right after you. You're doing something, or you were doing something, and we made it illegal, so now we're going to arrest you. That has been the big, you know, I'll just say, there's ways of saying it in the military, but it's not kosher. it's basically, it is a tyrannical tool of how people literally just, it's like a switch and bait type of thing. They'll have a lot of people go off and do something and go, you know, all the people are doing this, we don't like, so we want to get rid of them. And technically, a bill of attainder is basically targeting a class of people or group of people. And so these things were important. And the fact that Mr. Gary, maybe the bill of attainder, but the ex post facto, folks, today the federal government and the state governments are passing ex post facto laws. Throughout the states, one ex post facto law is if you own your property and you don't have a well on it, they've now made it illegal for you to put a well on it. Well, hold on here. It was legal when I bought it to put a well on it. You're just going to arbitrarily say now I can't have that property? Because would I have purchased that property if I couldn't put a well on it? Heck no. Does that make sense? I mean, they basically are rendering your property worthless, especially if it needs a well for it to, you know, function in any capacity of agriculture, what have you. You don't have access to water. So, yeah, I mean, this is, these men were seeing it, and this is the epitome of how things were coming together. Even though they didn't agree, you know, like with Mr. Gary on the point, these things were very important. So let's go forward with Mr. Ellsworth.
Yeah. Ellsworth. Mm-hmm. Mr. Ellsworth contended that there was no lawyer, no civilian who would not say that ex post facto laws were void of themselves. It cannot then be necessary to prohibit them. Mr. Wilson was against inserting anything in the Constitution as to ex post facto laws. It will bring reflections on the Constitution and proclaim that we are ignorant of the first principles of legislation or are constituting a government which will be so. The question being divided, the first part of the motion relating to bills of attainder was agreed to nem contradicente, no contest. On the second part relating to ex post facto laws, Mr. Carroll of Maryland remarked that experience overruled all other calculations. It had proved that in whatever that light they might be viewed by civilians or others, the state legislatures had passed them, and they had taken effect. Mr. Wilson from Pennsylvania, if these prohibitions in the state constitution have no effect, it would be useless to insert them in this constitution. Besides, both sides will agree to the principle and will differ as to its application. Mr. Williamson of North Carolina, such a prohibitory clause is in the Constitution of North Carolina, and though it has been violated, it has done good there and may do good here because the judges can take hold of it. Dr. Johnson of Connecticut thought the clause unnecessary and implying an improper suspicion of the national legislature. Mr. Rutledge, South Carolina, was in favor of the clause on the question for inserting the prohibition of ex post facto laws. New Hampshire voted aye, Massachusetts aye, Connecticut no, New Jersey no, Pennsylvania no, Delaware aye, Maryland aye, Virginia aye, North Carolina divided, South Carolina aye, and Georgia aye.
Okay, so 7-3, it carries. Okay, so now we go down. The report of the committee on the 5th, made by Mr. Rutledge, was taken up and postponed. They talk a little bit more about the committee of the 11th, the 11 delivered in their journal some more information. Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut, let's go ahead with that.
Oh, I thought it was an interesting note right there in the last comment. The report of the committee of 5, made by Mr. Rutledge, was taken up and then postponed, that each member might furnish himself with a copy. So they didn't have a copy of that from that committee, so they postponed it until they can all write down what they needed to know from it. Like they were passing it around the room.
Yeah.
The person was writing down what,
Or all, three kids on one side making their copies, people looking at it upside down.
The report of the Committee of 11 delivered in and entered on the Journal of the 21st, I'm not sure what that is for, was then taken up, and the first clause contained the words, "The legislature of the United States shall have power to fulfill the engagements which have been entered into by Congress being under consideration."
I think the INST may be inserted.
Probably.
Okay. All right. Mr. Ellsworth of Connecticut.
Mr. Ellsworth argued that they were unnecessary. The U.S. heretofore entered into engagements by Congress who were their agents. They will hereafter be bound to fulfill them by their new agent. Mr. Randolph of Virginia thought such a provision necessary, for though the United States will be bound, the new government will have no authority in the case unless it be given to them. Good point. Mr. Madison of Virginia thought it necessary to give the authority in order to prevent misconstruction. He mentioned the attempts made by the debtors to British subjects to show that contracts under the old government were dissolved by the revolution, which destroyed the political identity of the society. Mr. Gary of Massachusetts thought it essential that some explicit provisions should be made on the subject so that no pretext might remain for getting rid of the public engagements. Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania moved by way of amendment to substitute, quote, "The legislature shall discharge the debts and fulfill the engagements of the United States." It was moved to vary the amendment by striking out "discharge the debts" and to insert "liquidate the claims," which being negatived. The amendment moved by Mr. Governor Morris was agreed to, all the states being in the affirmative. It was moved and seconded to strike the following words out of the second clause of the report, "and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by the U.S. before a question was taken. The House adjourned.
Okay, so a question was taken, and as we look at picking up the next day, they bring up the militia itself. Okay, so now they're going to go ahead, and maybe the question was taken. Either way, Madison moves forward with this report of the Committee of 11 made. So apparently maybe everybody finally got their copy, and now they're ready to go. Okay.
The report of the committee – oh, you just read that?
No.
The report of the Committee of 11 made August 21, being taken up and the following clause being under consideration, to wit, quote, "to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia – and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed." Mm-hmm. Mr. Sherman moved to strike out the last member and authority of training, etc. He thought it unnecessary. The states will have this authority, of course, if not given up.
Okay. In other words, if it was given to, because that's the whole point of not giving up, if it was given to the federal government, then that means it was given up. So because it wasn't there, then why even put it in? It's something that they have. I believe that it needed to be in there, because if it's not, then states would go, because look at today. It's not in there, so, why should we do that? Because the federal government doesn't have the authority to do it. Somebody's got to do it. You got to do it. Anyway, it's lunacy in having to try to explain those things to people.
Yeah, and I was going to mention of what they talked about a little bit in the last section about if we put it in there, then people are going to be suspicious. And that reminded me of the conversation about the Bill of Rights and how, what was the point of the Bill of Rights when you only gave them the authority that's enumerated in this document? Why do you have to say, you can't do this and you can't do that? They don't have the authority to do it to start with. So
right, right.
They don't.
Yes, so the Bill of Rights.
It goes to this as well.
Right. So the Bill of Rights became important to be added, not to protect the people from the federal government, but down the road when the states finally ended slavery under the spilling of blood and under force and coercion, then there needed to be some kind of protections afforded. So when you really look at the divine nature of the Bill of Rights, it meant nothing until after the Civil War. Now, all of a sudden, those protections were now being applied to the states. I mean, it's not like there were these big atrocities between the ratification of the Bill of Rights to the Civil War that the federal government was out there taking away people's religious freedom and all these other things. I mean, that just wasn't happening. But after the Civil War, the states were literally doing that to the freemen. And now we can see the necessity, the heavenly necessity, of having those in hand. To me, that makes sense. It's like only he knew, only our Creator knew, that down the road they would be essential. So let's get them done now, because I believe that the fact of trying to get the Bill of Rights worked into the 14th Amendment would have been a nightmare. And so having them done by Madison and having them done, in such, advanced notice that it just, just made it so much simpler. Anyway, at least that's my 2 cents.
All right. Mr. Ellsworth doubted the propriety of striking out the sentence. The reason assigned applies as well to the other reservation of the appointment to offices. He remarked at the same time that the term discipline was of vast extent and might be so expounded as to include all power on the subject. Mr. King, by way of explanation, said that by organizing the committee meant proportioning the officers and men by arming, specifying the kind, size, and caliber of arms, and by disciplining, prescribing the manual exercise evolutions, etc. Mr. Sherman withdrew his motion. Mr. Gary, this power in the U.S. is explained as making the states drill sergeants. He had as little let the citizens, I'm not sure what that is, let the citizens of Massachusetts be disarmed, as to take the command from the states and subject them to the general legislature, it would be regarded as a system of despotism.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Madison observed that arming, as explained, did not extend to furnishing arms, nor the term discipline to penalties and courts-martial for enforcing them. Mr. King added to his former explanation that arming meant not only to provide for uniformity of arms, but included authority to regulate the modes of furnishing either by the militia themselves, the state governments, or the national treasury. That laws for disciplining must involve penalties and everything necessary for enforcing penalties.
Okay.
Mr. Dayton moved to postpone the paragraph in order to take up the following proposition. Quote, to establish a uniform and general system of discipline for the militia of these states and to make laws for organizing, arming, disciplining, and governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and all authority of the militia not herein given to the general government.
Okay, so
question, go ahead.
So in that Mr. King point, and he talks about, and as a matter of fact, might have been up a little bit. Mr. Madison observed that, quote, arming, close quote, as explained, did not extend the furnishing of arms, nor the term disciplining to the penalties and court martials for enforcing them. And so what then was the ultimate language? And so they kind of talk about it, but there's no quotations here. Mr. King added to his former explanation that arming meant not only to provide for the uniformity of arms, but included authority to regulate the modes of furnishing either by the militia themselves, the state governments, and or the national treasury. That laws for disciplining must involve penalties and everything necessary for enforcing the penalties. And so when you look at the Constitution and what it says as the end product, it says, Congress shall have the power to provide for organizing, to provide for arming, and to provide for discipline, because those are each independently and separate, not to be done, you know, all at once and it's all the same thing, like organizing, arming, and disciplining, to provide for organizing and to provide for arming and to provide for disciplining. So as far as I see the providing for arming, it is to ensure that the people and or the militia has arms in hand. Because when it comes down to the calling forth of the militia and these guys show up without arms, well, guess what? The federal government then has to put arms in their hands. And the concept, and I think this comes up later, and it definitely comes up in the ratification debates as well, that the concept of the states, you know, not being involved in this doesn't mean that they can't be involved in it. But if they are involved in it, they have to go with what's prescribed and what's being provided. In other words, the arms, ammo, caliber, that, all that type of stuff, as the U.S. government prescribed it and or provided. But when it comes down to prosecuting the war, let me ask you this. Who pays for the warfare? Congress. If Congress is going to pay to basically deploy the militia to repel invaders or to suppress insurrections or what have you, to engage in defending this nation, then they're going to have to pay to do those things. So to me, this idea of playing around with whether they had to pay for it or not, or provide it or not, I think became, and Madison was bringing this up, and I think it was kind of petty, just due to the fact that, what, now nobody bought them anything, they don't have anything, and now we need to defend ourselves. Federal government, does that mean you're not going to take care of it? Because that's their job. Now they can come back and blame the states for maybe not doing what they should have done, but bottom line, it had to be done. It has to be done. They have to have arms. They have to have ammo. So, anyway, Mr. Dayton, I think you probably started that already. Go ahead.
Yes. Move to postpone the paragraph in order to take up the follow. Oh, you want me to finish that?
Yeah, just go ahead.
Question and postpone.
Uh-huh.
On the question postpone in favor of this proposition, it passed in the negative.
Okay. All right, so then it failed. Okay, so Mr. Ellsworth and Sherman.
move to postpone the second clause in favor of the following, quote, to establish a uniformity of arms, to establish a uniformity of arms, exercise and organization for the militia, and to provide for the government of them when called into service of the United States, end quote. The object of this proposition was to refer the plan for the militia to the general government, but leave the execution of it to the state governments. Mr. Langdon said he could not understand the jealousy expressed by some gentlemen. The general and state governments were not enemies to each other, but different institutions for the good of the people of America. As one of the people, he could say, the national government is mine, the state government is mine. In transferring power from one to the other, I only take out of my left hand what I cannot so well use and put it into my right hand where it can be better used. Pretty naive. Mr. Gary thought it was rather taking out of the right hand and putting it into the left. Will any man say that liberty will be as safe in the hands of 80 or 100 men taken from the whole continent as in the hands of 200 or 300 taken from a single state? Mr. Dayton was against so absolute a uniformity. In some states, there ought to be a greater proportion of cavalry than in others. In some places, rifles would be most proper, in others, muskets, etc. General Pinckney preferred the clause reported by the committee, extending the meaning of it to the case of fines, etc.
Mr. Madison.
I was going to ask you, it'd be interesting to see how many of these people that are discussing this, which ones had military experience and which ones didn't. Because I think that has a lot to do with, you know, making sure that you understand.
Yeah, so let me just say this because we're almost out of time. And we'll pick up with our next show, starting off with Mr. Madison and the county and the militia. These men were very familiar in gun handling because that was one of the ways of providing for their families and eating and so forth. But whether they had military tactics training and that type of stuff might be something different because they lived a guarded life. They were kind of protected and guarded by the British Empire. And so there were some that got directly involved, like Washington, in the military, but not all. Now, at this point in time, they had a percentage of people exposed to, you know, the Continental Army and those things, but I just don't think that most of them did have, you know, the direct military experience. General Pinckney, of course, Colonel Mason, but I think many of these guys were more of either lawyers, politicians, and or had other types of professions. And so with that, we can kind of conclude. You know, we got through a lot today, but there's still some more that we want to cover because we're at that point of capturing some of these critical ideas, especially regarding the militia coming up. And so we will be diving into this in our next show. Thank you so much, and God bless. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.